From the salons of Victorian Britain to the gates of Auschwitz, this is the story of an idea which runs through some of the worst atrocities of the 20th century, an idea that echoes through the decades and resonates today. This is the story of eugenics, its dark history and its troubling present.
They came to Charlottesville prepared for confrontation. The Unite the Right protesters included neo-Nazis and members of the Ku Klux Klan.
So authorities say 11 of the 13 people shot by this white suspect were black. They're reviewing a 180-page manifesto reportedly written by the shooter, where he
describing himself as a white supremacist, as an anti-Semite, exposing that fringe conspiracy theory that white people are being systematically replaced in this country.
You have people who are angry and afraid that America is changing. You've got politicians talking about this whole replacement theory.
White supremacists, that chant, "You will not replace us," was the war cry of tiki torch-wielding protesters at Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017, followed by news coverage of shootings in Buffalo, New York, in May 2022. Those white supremacists and the murderer in Buffalo were all driven by an old idea, a conspiracy that some shadowy global elites, run by Jews, are deliberately trying to engineer the replacement of white people. The fear of a great replacement was also central to the rise of eugenics in the early 20th century. The idea that immigrants, minorities, and descendants of the enslaved were breeding too fast, and white people needed to fight back to preserve their dominion. In the last episode, we explored the nursery of eugenics in Victorian and Edwardian Britain. It never quite stuck there and was never codified into law. But in an increasingly interconnected world, the idea spread far and wide. December 1902, somewhere in the North Atlantic. A slim, serious man, dark suit, neatly trimmed beard, looks out to sea from the deck of an ocean liner, braced in the bitter wind. This is Charles Benedict Davenport, a 36-year-old American biologist. With his wife, Gertrude, he's homeward bound after a successful pilgrimage of sorts. In his breast pocket, he carries a signed letter of recommendation from none other than Francis Galton, the father of eugenics. And he's feeling good, buoyed by
a renewed courage for the study of evolution.
But it's not natural selection that this Harvard man will dedicate the rest of his life to. It's artificial selection, the selective breeding of animals and people.
Man is an organism, an animal. And the laws of improvement of corn and racehorses apply to him also. Permanent advance is to be made only by securing the best blood.
Also on this boat, and so many others just like it, another group is making the same journey, though for them, it's the first time. Crowded into steerage on the lower decks, hundreds of parents, grandparents, and young children are leaving Europe for good. In these years, America is the destination for the huddled masses yearning to breathe free, as the welcoming poem on the Statue of Liberty declares. Millions of Russians, Italians, Poles, Serbians, Irish, Jews, and other immigrants set foot on New York soil in the first two decades of the 20th century, escaping poverty or persecution, or just looking for the promise of a better life, the American dream. For Davenport and the upper classes on the top deck, this is a defining controversy of the era. People coming to America and expecting to be treated like citizens.
They had come to him friendless and starving, when from tyrant's oppression they fled. But now they abuse and revile him, till at last in just anger he said, "If you don't like your Uncle Sammy, then go back to your home or the sea, to the land from where you came, whatever be its name."
It's Sometimes the term revolution is overused, but the Industrial Revolution in America, roughly speaking, 1870 to 1920, was indeed a revolution, and it changed everything.
This is Dr. Thomas Leonard, an historian and economist from Princeton University.
You can think of it, if you want, as a kind of massive ongoing economic earthquake that is pushing tsunamis of change, social change, economic change, political change, into every corner of American life. So this is the historical moment when the United States economically surpasses the German Empire, French Empire, Japanese Empire, and catches the British Empire, the famous 19th century global colossus. It's safe to say that the world has never seen anything like it.
This economic revolution was powered in no small part by these immigrants arriving in huge numbers.
That spectacular rise in American economic output required workers. Roughly 15 million immigrants arrived between 1890 and 1914. 15 million, with a population around 75 million at the turn of the century. By 1910, about a quarter of the U.S. workforce is foreign-born. And if we look at the unskilled labor supply, about 40% is foreign-born.
This ongoing earthquake of demographic change was met with horror by the American old stock elites, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, the political leaders, captains of industry, and the cultural elite. Of course, the so-called old stock weren't especially old. Their forebears had arrived throughout the previous two centuries, Northern European immigrants who'd come from Britain, the Netherlands, and Germany. The new immigrants were mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe, predominantly Catholics, Jews, or Eastern Orthodox Christians. With a head start of a couple of centuries, the American WASPs held the power and the wealth. And preeminent amongst them was the indomitable Theodore Teddy Roosevelt, America's 26th president, a two-termer from 1901 to 1909. Roosevelt was worried about one issue above all.
Roosevelt says in 1907... that race suicide is the greatest problem of civilization.
Now, in episode one, we heard the eugenicists of Victorian Britain were terrified that the poor were outbreeding the middle classes, and Churchill convinced that the rapid growth of the feeble-minded constituted a national and race danger. Well, race suicide is basically the same idea, but reminted in the American context as a response to mass immigration.
So race suicide is a theory, Edward A. Ross's theory, of how inferior races outbreed their biological betters. The idea is this. Workers of so-called inferior races are able to live on less than is the American working man. And by American, what's meant here is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And because they're able to live on less, these immigrant workers accept lower wages. And the American working man refuses to reduce his living standards to the immigrant's low level and instead opts to have fewer children. And thus did the inferior races outbreed their biological betters.
And the idea that the aristocratic Americans of North European descent were in danger of being replaced gripped powerful figures across politics, industry, and culture. And that brings us to the Great Gatsby. What comes to mind when you think about F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterful novel? Perhaps it's jazz age glamour, or flapper girls, the hedonistic lifestyle of America's ultra-rich. I've always thought of Gatsby as a horror story. It's murderous and tragic and so casually cruel. That's why it's one of my favourite books. The lavish parties are definitely in there, but what about the clear expression of white supremacy? And yes, eugenics, right there from the beginning of the greatest of the great American novels. Listen to this clip from a BBC Radio 4 adaptation from 2012. The Yale-educated millionaire bully, Tom Buchanan, patronisingly schools his wife on a popular science book that he's just read.
Have you read The Rise of the Cullen Empires by Goddard?
No.
Well, you oughta. Everybody ought to read it. The idea is if we don't look out, the white race will be...
slaughtered in its bed.
Submerged. That's the word. Utterly submerged. It's a fine book. It's scientific. Mm-hmm.
Claret after cocktails makes Tom profound. I've seen it before.
Markle, you like Jordan, but you can't deny it. The white race, we Nordics...
I didn't know I was Nordic.
The white race has produced all the things that go to make civilization.
What things?
You know, the science, art.
Petroleum and Lillian Gish.
Don't tease too much, Jordan.
People forget that The Great Gatsby is a novel about modern life in 1922. And Great Replacement Theory was absolutely central to American cultural discourse in the early 1920s. This is how people that Fitzgerald knew spoke. This was the ideas that were current.
This is Sarah Churchwell, Professor of American Literature at the University of London. And my love of The Great Gatsby is eclipsed by her expertise. Buchanan cites this book that he's read by a scientist called Goddard, and it's called The Rise of the Colored Empires. But what is he really referring to?
He's referring to a real best-selling book by a writer called Lothrop Stoddard, which was called The Rising Tide of Color. It was a best-selling, ostensibly nonfiction work in 1920 and 1921. It had a foreword written by another eugenicist called Madison Grant, who was the most famous eugenicist in America. He himself had written a huge best-selling book called The Passing of the Great Race. And they're really both kind of Great Replacement Theory stories.
We'll come to Madison Grant in a future episode. But both books here push the idea that white America is under threat from inferior racial groups, outbreeding them and diluting the bloodline. But I wanted to know, was this stuff just circulating amongst the wealthy and the intelligentsia? Is this a conversation that's happening on the street as well?
Absolutely. So this was suffusing American cultural conversations at the time. It's in every single newspaper, every single magazine. Saturday Evening Post was the most popular magazine in America in the 1920s. And the editor, who was called Horace Lorimer, was obsessed with this idea. He ran editorials on it, you know, on a weekly basis. You couldn't pick up any kind of popular culture at the time and not instantly encounter this idea. It was on the bestseller lists. It was in the newspapers and magazines. Good Housekeeping was running articles about it. I mean, it was just literally everywhere.
By this stage, you're saying that it's sort of culturally normalized, this conversation about Great Replacement Theory and white supremacy is just throughout American culture. Where else does it crop up before Gatsby?
It really dominated American cultural debates from 1900 to 1930, broadly. It reaches a peak in the early years of the 1920s, particularly because there were major political debates at that time around restricting immigration. So every newspaper you pick up, you know, it's reporting on Congress and the political leaders who are fighting to create immigration, restrictionist immigration laws and to pass them. So, you know, from 1890 to 1920, it's pretty much everywhere.
The fear of race suicide expressed by Teddy Roosevelt was common amongst supporters of this restrictionist political movement, people who campaigned to drastically reduce immigration levels. But again, these ideas weren't just held by politicians. They were widespread.
It is also bound up with, other groups and movements at that time. For example, the slogan America First, which, you know, people now associate with Trump, but it was also incredibly popular in the teens and the 20s. It's kind of like a bumper sticker culture, right? I mean, that's how pervasive it was. People are marching around with banners that read, you know, America First, you know, white nativism, keep America for Americans. I mean, it's that kind of level of ubiquity.
And these attitudes spilled over into violence, against African Americans and against the new European immigrants.
It was also associated at the same time in its most violent form with the Ku Klux Klan, which was on the rise at the same time and basically was, you know, the kind of paramilitary arm of these ideas. And so people take these ideas and they violently enact them because the Klan wasn't, people know that it was racist and that it was anti-Black American, but they don't always realize that it was anti-immigrant as well. And they were lynching immigrants and they were terrorizing immigrants. And they were also policing intermarriage and intersexual relationships between Black and white, because all of this was about maintaining white power and making sure that it didn't get biologically, I'm doing that very much in air quotes, that it didn't get, that the basis of white superiority wasn't racially undermined.
Here is the eugenic core of replacement fears and the theory of race suicide. The idea that white Americans of North European, Nordic descent are a biologically distinct race, distinct from African Americans, the descendants of the enslaved, but also from the Catholic and Jewish and Orthodox immigrants arriving in great numbers from Southern and Eastern Europe. For the eugenicists, mixing bloodlines, interbreeding between these so-called races, would lead to the degeneration of white America. Well, that was then. What about now? Remember the white supremacists at the Unite the Right rally in 2017, chanting, "You will not replace us." Is that the same idea a century later?
100%. And almost without change. And they didn't just say, "You will not replace us." They said, "Jews will not replace us," right? That was the rhyme. So there is, it also connects back to the, ancient conspiracy theories about anti-Semitism too. So it is almost exactly the same thing 100 years later. It has barely iterated. It is essentially exactly the same threat, fear, paranoid conspiracy theory playing itself out again.
These eugenic ideas permeate Jazz Age society at every level. Henry Ford, motor car magnate and virulent anti-Semite, was a vocal cheerleader of the Great Replacement conspiracy theory. John Harvey Kellogg, co-inventor of the cornflake, used his wealth to set up the Race Betterment Foundation with leading eugenicists on the board. Eugenics is everywhere in American culture. Back to Gatsby, or rather to its creator, Francis Scott Keyes Fitzgerald, because it's no coincidence that one of the themes of The Great Gatsby is the white supremacist momentum of this time. His inspiration for the novel comes from some of the most influential figures in the American eugenics movement.
Fitzgerald later said that he based the Buchanans partly on a family called the Rumseys, who were polo-playing elite aristocratic couple on Long Island. And Mary Harriman Rumsey was the daughter of E.H. Harriman, who was a railroad tycoon, one of the richest men in America, you know, incredibly famous as a result. So, you know, people need to think about these tycoons at that time as being very much like big tech billionaires today. They're household names, right? Everybody knows they're the richest men in America. And she's the daughter of the richest man in America. And she went to Barnard, where she studied. And while she was there, she encountered the ideas of eugenics. She became so enamored of those ideas that her classmates nicknamed her Eugenia. And her teacher at Barnard was none other than Charles Davenport.
Charles Davenport, our neatly bearded transatlantic pilgrim from the beginning of this episode. Inspired and endorsed by Francis Galton, Davenport dedicated the rest of his life to the science of inheritance and the ideology of eugenics in the USA. To do so, he needed money. So who better to turn to than the richest woman in America whose daughter he had taught? Mary Harriman, widow of a railroad tycoon and a key figure in the American aristocratic social scene. And who else? John Rockefeller, maybe the richest man in American history, whose untold millions had come from owning the monopoly of Standard Oil. So with tens of thousands of dollars worth of annual gifts from Mary Harriman and the Rockefeller Foundation, Davenport sets up the Eugenics Record Office in 1910 at Cold Spring Harbor, just a few miles from the Hamptons and the other Long Island mansions where Jay Gatsby pined for Daisy. Cold Spring Harbor was already an established lab when Davenport founded the ERO, and today it's one of the great global centers of genetics research. But it's here that Davenport sets up the hub of the American eugenics movement, a command center for the purification of white America. One of Davenport's first recruits is a man called Harry Hamilton Lachlan, a Princeton scientist and faithful eugenic zealot. Here's Professor Joe Kane.
I'd like to think of him as the bruiser to Charles Davenport's brains. There's a really famous historian, Dan Kevles, and he described Laughlin as a workhorse, humorless, intolerant of criticism, and continually afire with dogmatic zeal. And I think of that as really quite right.
Laughlin is a feisty, smart guy, and now, amped up with the funding, the resources, and the credibility of the Eugenics Record Office, he was on a mission.
Laughlin's not so much interested in the research side. He's interested in the policy making and the implementation side. He's the bruiser. He's the one who wants to get out there and to effect change. He is a massive racist. He's a massive anti-Semite. He's also absolutely, massively anti-immigration. And that's important to his identity, and it's important to his policy agenda when he gets going at the Eugenic Records Office. He starts to lobby on anti-immigration laws, and he starts to lobby on compulsory sterilization.
We know that the white establishment is routinely talking about the problems of race and of a great replacement. They believe their own race to be distinct and superior to those coming into America in their millions. So, you have a powerful lobby with scientific kudos and a plan for action. The question now was whether Davenport and Laughlin could get acceptance of these ideas into law. They were on a mission to save America. With some shrewd lobbying, Laughlin caught the attention of the chairman of the Immigration Committee, Representative Albert Johnson, and got himself appointed as the committee's expert eugenic agent. He was commissioned to write a report on the eugenics of immigration and granted access to the records of state institutions. In 1922, his moment arrived. He returned to present his findings to the committee, armed with reams of new data. And it is reams, 120 pages worth. Could Laughlin persuade the committee to embed eugenics into a new anti-immigration law? A cold Tuesday morning in November 1922, we're in a large formal hearing room in Washington, D.C., the heart of government. A raised wooden dais curves around one end of the room, desks for 15 congressmen. These tribunal rooms are where laws are made and tested, and these men are the lawmakers responsible for crafting America's immigration policy. But before the proceedings officially begin, the congressmen browse a temporary gallery. Harry Laughlin has arranged a series of photographs from Ellis Island, the place where millions made footfall on US soil for the first time, the Statue of Liberty watching over them a few hundred yards away. The images depict queues of immigrants waiting to be processed by medical and administrative officials. And the title card reads, "Carriers of the Germplasm of the Future American Population." The chair, Representative Johnson, calls the room to order.
The committee will please now come to order. Dr. Harry Laughlin has now completed an investigation of the relative degeneracies in each of the groups in the population of the United States. I will ask Dr. Laughlin to proceed at length, giving us all possible information concerning the facts which he has secured.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen of the committee, we in this country have been so imbued with the idea of democracy, or the equality of all men, that we have left out of consideration the matter of blood and natural, inborn mental and moral differences. No man who breeds pedigreed plants and animals can afford to neglect this thing, as you know. But in adding to our human breeding stock by immigration, this is what we do. We keep out fairly...
Over the next couple of hours, Laughlin presents his specific conclusions. He sifted the records of state institutions, asylums and prisons, and applying some pretty dubious statistical assumptions, Laughlin has scored immigrants and their recent descendants from more than 60 countries. He calculates, for example, that Serbians have the highest proportion of the feeble-minded. The most criminal groups are, again, Serbians, followed by Spanish and Mexicans. He determines that native whites, where both parents are foreign-born, exhibit the highest levels of deformity and disability. And so on, page after page after page of bar charts and tables and numbers. But for the committee, who are keen on setting immigration limits for different groups, this is just the ticket. As Lachlan explains, his numbers are intended to provide
a measure of the degree to which each racial and nativity group must be culled or sifted by the federal government in preventing immigration.
2 years later, the committee passes the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act, all but closing the borders.
In 1924, the United States basically shut the door. They shut the door primarily on two groups of people. They shut the door on all of Asia, literally all of Asia. And they also excluded immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. After the Johnson-Reed Act, American immigration plunged by 97%.
The restrictionist movement was not motivated purely by eugenic considerations of racial purity. Anti-immigration sentiment came from many groups with different motives. But it is nevertheless a huge victory for Harry Lachlan and the eugenics priesthood. This was not the first law banning immigrants based on race or nationality. Chinese immigrants who built much of the railroad network responsible for the Industrial Revolution had been barred from entering the US in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. But this was the most dramatic. Davenport, Lachlan, and the work of the Eugenics Record Office had provided Congress with a scientific reason to shut the borders. Spurious, misguided pseudoscience, in fact. But the authority and confidence of these men of science gave them every justification they needed. As Davenport once wrote,
"Can we build a wall high enough around this country so as to keep out these cheaper races?"
Migration is the story of humankind. We've never settled in one place for very long. The question of immigration is as much part of today's politics as it was in Jazz Age America. Then, though, they turned to scientists for justification. Scientists who were also ideologues, obsessed with racial purity and the replacement of their kin. But the question remains. In a world where people move to escape persecution or war, or simply to pursue a better life, how does a society decide who to welcome and who to reject? In the next episode of Bad Blood, we explore the battle of birth control, from the push to sterilise the so-called feeble-minded, to the first-wave feminists fighting for women's right to contraception, while simultaneously trying to stop the poorest from having babies at all.